The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. Good evening. Good evening. Can we make the volume be just a little bit higher so I don't have to throw my voice? Thank you. Thank you. So many of us, we have this idea that we'd like to have a mindfulness practice. Presumably, that's part of the reason why you're here. And we're practicing in the middle of our life. We're not sitting in a cave somewhere, isolated from everything, but instead we're practicing whatever we might define practice as, trying to be like maybe present for our life, present for ourselves. We're doing this in the midst of work, relationships, health issues, all kinds of difficulties. And so there's this way in which we may come to the cushion, so to speak, to meditate. And sometimes we might arrive and feel inspired and like, okay, I'm ready. I'm going to practice. I'm going to do mindfulness. Or, as very often is the case, I'm imagining, you come to the cushion, if you come to the cushion, maybe distracted, bored, irritated, uninspired. And so there's this way in which we might think, okay, well, I just need to have more willpower. I should have more self-discipline. I should have more effort so that I'll just get to the cushion, which, of course, I'm using just to symbolize meditating, whatever, whether you sit on a cushion or not. We have this idea that we should just force ourselves to come to the cushion, and if only we were better somehow, then we would meditate more regularly, or meditation would be easier, or it would be having the transformation in our lives that we're hoping for, that we're wishing for. But practice needs support. It's not just about willpower. It needs some nourishment, we might say. It needs some encouragement. It needs some conditions. Of course it does. Especially when, let's be honest, it seems like so much of our society is kind of promoting the opposite of being present for your life. It's all about, here's how to distract yourself. Here's one more thing. Like there's even, I remember it was not too long ago, and I don't remember if it was a billboard or whatever, another occasion. It was the advertisement, something like, indulge, you deserve it, you know. I'm not saying there was anything wrong with doing something nice for oneself, but if the message that we get all the time is like, you know, just forget about dreams you might have, things you want to do, just indulge in whatever you feel like this moment. So in order to do something that's different than the message that we get in so many different ways, in so many different media, it takes support. So a question we might ask is what supports us in turning towards life? What supports us in turning towards being with our experience, meditating, have a practice, or whatever it is you want to do, something that's important to you that you want to do? What's the support when we forget? What's the support when we'd rather just avoid and distract? What's the support when it just feels dry and mechanical and uninspiring? What's the support when we feel afraid? We don't even quite know why, but just we don't want to sit still. It's not something maybe we can clearly articulate. Or what if we just don't even know why, we just don't want to? So we need some support. So I'd like to offer some supports for practice. Three activities that can be a support. This is not part of any list, Buddhist lists. In fact, most of these words aren't even on Buddhist lists. But these are things that I think can be helpful and that have been helpful for me in my life to, you know, just maybe like articulate them and to have them in mind as something, as opposed to this sense like, okay, I just have to try harder. So the first support I'd like to offer is this idea of aspiration. What do we care about? What do we want our life to be about? What is the heart's direction? What matters to us? This isn't pressure. This isn't about having the inner critic raise up and say, oh, you should do this and do that. It's just worthwhile sometimes to just check in. What matters to us? What do we want to live toward? And so this isn't so much about what do we want, because want has this feeling of, you know, grasping and reaching, and I'm doing this with my hands, right? I'm like holding on to something. What we want often involves comparing and measuring and all that kind of stuff. Aspiration is something different. Aspiration is more about opening or softening. What helps us to feel like, yeah, that's a direction I want to go. Maybe in the way in which you wish upon a star when you see a shooting star or something like that. So aspiration is a way in which can give practice meaning. Like, why are we doing this? Why are we doing meditation practice? Because we don't want our meditation practice to be another project, another task. But instead, can we have the heart get involved? Is there a way in which we can remember what's important to us and align this to with what's important? It's not always easy to remember this. So it's worthwhile sometimes. We find things to remember, practical things, post-it notes, reminders on the calendar, whatever it is for you. But then the risk of doing that is that it turns into a project or a task or something like this. But allowing your heart to touch into what it really wants can be a powerful support. Sometimes we might say that what we want is freedom. And we can define freedom as not being pushed around, but instead the freedom to do what you believe is the right thing to do for you at that moment. Instead of always chasing our preferences, like, oh, that's, I feel uncomfortable with that. I can't do that. I have to avoid this person because they might say that thing that they said last time or whatever it might be. So freedom. There's so many different ways that it can be understood, defined. Maybe freedom is an aspiration. Or maybe truth. This seeing clearly about ourselves, about others, about the way, the nature of reality. Maybe to see clearly is an aspiration, to no longer be confused or about what's important or what you want to do with your life. Or maybe freedom, truth, and love. Maybe to give love, receive love, to be warm-hearted, to be open, to be connected. Maybe this is an aspiration. I offer these just as suggestions. Each of you might have your own. But maybe just an encouragement to dream big. Why not? Have a big, beautiful life. So aspiration can be a support for mindfulness practice or for anything that you want to do. But there's a way in which aspiration enough is often isn't sufficient, can't help us get to the cushion necessarily single-handedly. Sometimes it can, but often we need something more. And I'd like to suggest this idea of trust. Trust as this second support. So trust is this, it's not this blind belief that like, okay, if I'm going to do this, then everything's going to be fine. Sometimes there's this way in which we might associate this word trust with faith or belief or something like this. And then that starts to sound like, oh, I just have to adopt some doctrine or some creed or, you know, something like this. That's not what I'm saying, and it's not what's being pointed to. And Buddhist practice is definitely about trust that comes from experience. So we might call it confidence that comes from experience, not because anybody told you anything in particular. It's more of just having realize that, oh yeah, after I meditate, things are a little bit more clear or I feel a little bit better. Not always. No guarantee that when you sit down to meditate, it's going to be great and that all the answers are going to be known to all the questions you have. No guarantees about this. Sometimes you'll get up from the cushion and think like, wow, okay, I'm not sure what that was all about. But there's something that happens. Say that you have a meditation session and the mind is busy going everywhere except where you were thinking that you wanted it to go. You want it to be settled and calm, and the mind is rehearsing something it's going to do in the future and rehashing something that happened in the past and busy, and you spend the whole time just thinking, and then the timer goes off. You're like, oh, wow, okay. But there's something that happens if you have stayed with it. And what happens is you realize, oh, that wasn't so bad. I survived that. We often have this idea that meditation has to look a particular way. And if it doesn't look that way, well, we should just abandon it or go do something else or pick up these small rectangular devices we like to carry in our pockets. There's a way in which, you know, there's a certain amount of confidence, like, oh, okay. Yeah. So a session that maybe was felt when the mind was really busy wasn't the end of the world, wasn't the end of anything. It was okay. And that's a little bit of this confidence, because there will be also sessions in which you afterwards you feel like there's a certain more settledness or calmness or a sense of ease or openness or softness that opens up and realize, oh yeah, okay, this is great. I do feel a little bit more relaxed, less anxious, less like I can find my way through this particular difficulty. And that gives confidence too. That with practice can be a support for your life. So this trust begins in this lived experience, not only on the meditation cushion, but when we notice that when we pause in the midst of maybe a difficult conversation or pause before hitting send on that text or that email that was had a little biting tone to it. Or maybe confidence grows when we realize that just meeting that difficult person with some kindness and noticing that the interaction shifts when you don't respond in a way that is meeting kind of like hostility with hostility. Maybe you may feel like, I don't know. I don't have any of this trust. I don't have any of this confidence. I don't have any of this faith. Somebody's making me sit and meditate, and I'm just doing it because I'm supposed to, or whatever it might be. I love this expression that I heard first from Andrea Fella years ago, and she used this, well, trust can be borrowed. Use somebody else's trust. And that what she meant by that is maybe there's a teacher, a book, somebody who gives a Dharma talk, a podcast you listen to, and they seem to have a lot of trust, or they're talking about how it has changed their life having a practice. And there can be a way, it's like, well, if it worked for them, maybe it can work for me. Or they seem to talk about how they have their life has been changed, or they seem to have the qualities that I would like to cultivate. So I'm going to borrow their trust. I like this idea because it somehow takes the pressure off of having to feel inspired or trusting all the time. So maybe it's not even an individual. Maybe it's a community. Maybe it's, there's something about coming to practice together that really maybe supports that. I know for me, early in my meditation practice, I would often want to sit with others. And it was, honestly, when I look back on it, sometimes it was just pure peer pressure. That's why I didn't get up and just run out. I just felt like, oh, I don't want to be here. But sometimes they're just like, okay, well, everybody else is sitting quietly and I don't want to disturb anybody. I guess I'll stay. And then it was just part of this confidence started to grow, and my ability to sit still just started to grow. Not because I did any heroic efforts. It was just coming to just exactly as you guys are. It's coming to sit and then staying, even though I felt like leaving. So in some ways, we could call that like borrowing trust, having the support from the community. But trust doesn't remove difficulties. It doesn't make the difficulties go away. It just gives us a belief and understanding that we can meet some of our aspirations, that things that are important to us, they're possible. There's a way in which they could happen. There's a way forward. But there can be a way in which there's difficulty, there's pain, there's fear, there's what, maybe we're not even clear what the barrier or the hesitation is, there's just something. So even though we have trust, even though we have aspiration, it might not be enough. We could use some other supports, something else. And I'd like to offer a third support, and this is courage. And this certainly was not something that I expected on my meditation journey. It certainly isn't on lists that we hear, the Buddhist lists, this idea of courage. Courage is not fearlessness. It's, you know, recognizing that there is fear and not fleeing as best we can, staying as best we can. So some of you will be familiar with this story in the Buddha's awakening. Before he was awakened, he sat down underneath a Bodhi tree and said that he wasn't going to move until he became completely awakened. That's a tremendous amount of confidence. After having practiced for many years and felt like, okay, I'm just going to, it's so important to me, I'm just going to make this happen in some way. So he's sitting under the Bodhi tree meditating when Mara shows up. Mara is the personification of somebody, it gets interpreted in different ways. I like to think of it as Mara is what gets in the way. So the story is that Mara shows up with a battle, with all this, a whole battalion of all these creatures that are throwing things at the Buddha while he's sitting there under the tree. rocks and mud and fire and all these things are getting thrown at the Buddha. And he does something very difficult. He stays. He stays there under the tree. He doesn't run away. And then in one version of this story with his meditation, these arrows that are like with fire or the mud and the rocks and lava, I don't remember all the things that are getting thrown at him. They get, many of them turn into flowers. Just the power of his, I don't know what it was exactly, just the willingness to be with whatever was arising. The willingness to say, you know, I've run away so many times. What happens when I don't? I feel inspired by this, actually. It takes courage. Because sometimes what happens when we're meditating is we start to have insights. And some of these insights include understanding about ourselves. Greater self-understanding. And I heard Gil say this years ago, and I remember this. He said something along the lines of, and this self-understanding, this greater understanding about ourselves, like what makes us tick and how we work, this kind of thing, is rarely good news. It's more like, oh, I didn't realize I had that really bad habit or this pattern of avoiding or distraction or blaming or anger or all these things that we do when we encounter difficulties. And it's often not until we actually do sit still and meet them that we start to learn some of our patterns of meeting difficulties. And what's happening on the cushion is the exact same thing that happens in our daily life. So we start to learn about ourselves in a way that maybe we hadn't seen before, some of our blind spots. And sometimes it takes courage to see, like, oh yeah, sometimes I'm kind of a jerk when I feel confused. I just am short with people and start bossing them around just because I want to feel less confused. Or maybe you start to see how you shut down and collapse and just stop meeting the world when there are difficulties. And that can be really difficult to move away from, or to, you know, to bring some enlivening and stay connected. So courage isn't the elimination of fear. It's meeting fear, staying present with whatever's arising when you feel like you'd rather not. And sometimes, I mean, I told this little story about Mara and the Buddha, so often we might think of courage as some heroic, you know, big movement. But often it's just a quiet staying. Maybe a little pause. Maybe being with the breath, a few more breaths before the mind jumps off. Maybe it's just one honest recognition. This takes courage. Maybe it's just willingness to not turn away. And of course, we practice courage in a way that suits who we are and where we are at that moment. I'm not saying that we always have to stay with the most difficult thing no matter what. That's not always the wise thing to do. But it's not always wise to bounce off and distract and avoid either. So each of us have to find our balance of how much can we meet difficulty and how much do we need to make sure that we have enough resources and support before we really meet those difficulties. Each of us has to find that for ourselves. This isn't all about like this warrior, I'm going to go in and no matter what, like this story that I told of the Buddha. That's a story. I don't know what happened. I don't know any of this. But I do appreciate this idea that somebody had this determination and he stayed. So courage may be quiet, and it may just be this facing the suffering. But one thing it is that it remains open. It allows us to remain open even in the midst of vulnerability. Because the truth is, humans are vulnerable. We are. We don't like to be. Of course we don't. We are emotionally vulnerable. We are physically vulnerable. Our feelings get hurt. We get sick. Things that we love, people that we care about, creatures we care about, die. Our heart gets broken. This is what it means to be a human. And so courage is, despite this vulnerability, can we stay open? That is, can we allow our hearts to be touched? Can we allow ourselves to feel the fear and how much we don't want to feel the vulnerability or feel the discomfort? So courage doesn't make us invulnerable. It just prevents us from completely shutting down or armoring up. And there's this way that courage is about just beginning again. Sometimes it feels like there's hope. It feels faint. Like there's, you know, just not a lot of hope. And there can be sometimes a way in which we want to like collapse after a failure, let's say, or collapse after a big loss. Excuse me. Or after disappointment or these things that happen in our lives. And courage is to be able to feel the pain. It's kind of like honor our experience, because of course there's grief. Of course there's sadness. Of course maybe there's some anger or confusion. And can we meet them in a way that's wise and helpful and supportive without turning away, but to begin again? And to begin again, it might sound like a small thing, but it's not small. In fact, we could say that all the practice is about this. It's just, you know, beginning again and again, this act of trust, maybe some aspiration and courage. So aspiration, trust, and courage. I'd like to offer some supports for practice for whatever's actually important for you. We could say that aspiration gives a direction, and without aspiration, courage may not know its direction. It may encourage you to just like keep on pushing and pushing, even though it's not going in a direction that provides more freedom, for example. Or there's a way in which trust steadies the heart. Because without trust, courage may become strain. It's just about me showing that I can do it to myself or to others. Or there's this way that without courage, aspiration and trust may just remain ideas. It may something like, oh yeah, that sounds good. I'll get to that eventually. As soon as my life is fixed, I have everything perfect or something like that. So practice isn't something that we force through pure willpower, but instead we need to support it. And tonight I'm offering three supports. Aspiration, to connect to what really matters to us. Trust, trust yourself. Trust that there is a way forward. And courage. Courage, even if there is difficulty or uncomfortableness, can you stay with it in a way that, again, that is for each of us, this will be different, what that looks like, but in a way that is wise and supportive of the life that you'd want. So may we remember what matters. May we trust what supports freedom, and however you define freedom for yourself. And may we have courage to turn towards this life with an open heart. Aspiration, trust, and courage. Thank you. And with that, I'd like to open it up now to see if there's some questions or comments. Okay. Oh, we'll use the microphone back here. Thank you, Jim.
Hi. You talked about feeling the fear. How do you feel the fear without being overwhelmed by it, by being entering into it?
Yeah. How do you feel fear without being overwhelmed by it? There's a few things we can do. One is to really feel the experience in the body. The mind is going to like, oh my gosh, this is going to happen, and then this is going to happen. The mind is making stories. By definition, fear is encouraging this future thoughts. But to be with the experience, feel the lump in the throat, the knot in the belly. Maybe the heart is beating faster. And so in that way, to be with what's actually happening now interrupts all the future thinking thoughts that accompany fear. I'm not talking about tigers or, you know, being hit by a car or anything like this. I'm talking about other types of fear. So to be present in the moment, in the bodily experience. But sometimes that alone isn't even enough. Or we don't have access to that. So something to make it even simpler is to like feel your feet on the ground, just to feel like, okay, no, I'm here. And then the mind is going to want to say, no, there's this thing and you got to take care of this and blah, blah, blah. And there's a way in which you can say, I'm going to think about that later. Right now, I'm just going to be with my feet on the ground and a couple of breaths. And then the mind will protest. And then you will say, I'll get to this later, but right now I'm just going to put my feet on the ground and a few breaths. So it's not the first time you come to the bodily experience, the mind will still want to pull you away, but it's the thoughts that are making the fear feel unbearable and the overwhelm. And we can interrupt the thoughts by being with the physical experience. Is that helpful?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think over here there was a question too, is that right? Or isn't, you don't have to. If you've changed your mind.
Well, related to fear, something which a lot of people, including me sometimes, are afraid of is death. And this is also a Buddhist motivation to practice. death. So it's interesting.
Yeah. So there's a lot of practices associated with you know, fear of death, and some of you might be familiar with this. I'll just say a few of them briefly, and Daniel, I imagine you know them. Maranasati, mindfulness of death. So just like there's guided meditations, you know, imagine this is your last hour or week, you know, day, hour, minute, or something like this, or imagine what it's like, death. So just this practice turning towards it. This is the courage part, right? You actually just turn towards everything that has the nature to be born as the nature to die. It's not a mystery. We all know this, and yet somehow we're avoiding this. So one is to intentionally bring mindfulness to death about it. And then other one is just like these five recollections, and one of the recollections is to say, I am of the nature to die, I think is the saying for it. So these are some of these practices. And then people who do this practice discover that their life starts to become more meaningful, starts to become more tender, that they start to become more present for everything, and more joy starts to arise. We all have this idea it's going to be morose or macabre or a little crazy-making. It turns out to be a lot of freedom to turn towards what we fear. It turns to give freedom. You can go on retreats that are all about death meditation, and they end up being so joyful at the end. It's when you turn towards something that you feel like you've been avoiding so much, and you finally look at it, and it's kind of normalized, and you're within a community, like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm going to die, and so are you, and so are you, and so are you, and so. Okay, so thank you. Thank you for your kind attention. Wish you a wonderful rest of the evening and safe travels home. Thank you.